Hey, everybody. John, snuck in there, I didn't see you. This is a fun book, huh?
Yeah.
It's good, right? It's a little treat, exercises in style. So let's begin with a question that will sound really obvious, but the fact that we can ask that question will only be because we've covered certain ground. Right, so just when you think you have no idea what's happening, that you're getting frustrated, you're like, this guy's recasting the very terms of argument for me, he's going to ask me to write a paper, I don't know what the freak he wants. I'm going to ask you a question. And again, I think the question will sound obvious to you, but I think, again, it will only be obvious because of the ground we've covered. So my question is, what argument does this text make? Why is that a surprising question? Do you find that a surprising question?
Well, it doesn't appear to give an argument.
Good.
It doesn't, in the typical sense of the word.
In what sense? In the typical sense, what do you mean? Be more explicit. Use the language we've already used this semester.
I will argue, even in that the author will go, writing is the destruction of so and so, as what you would consider an argument. I don't know technically.
Right, so maybe it's constative or declarative, right? I mean, constative is a good word. I want you guys to kind of put on your belt. But exactly right. The text never comes out and says, this is what I believe. But it seems pretty clear, doesn't it, that this text is making an argument, making a lot of arguments, making a lot of very complex arguments. Yeah, Augustus. Okay, so Augustus is suggesting that it's just an exercise, if you will, in what language can do. That it's really like language pyrotechnics in a sense. Like, okay. Are you making a claim about it, or are you making an argument about what the text is arguing?
The text is arguing that there's different stories within one story, depending on the language you use.
Okay, there's different stories within one story. Is story really the right word? Are these all stories?
Yeah.
I mean, I look at page 79, and I get into a book full of passing, I know, I am a who's, resentment, to about. Doesn't seem too story-driven at that point. And I'm not picking on you. This is what's interesting is how I want to watch you try to formulate what's happening here and watch how all the words and language we use will have to be questioned. Right? For instance, story, because I think this really begs a question of story in very complicated ways. But it also, what was the other thing you said? You said it's one story is many stories. But is there one story? Might it be that there are only many stories? Is there one? Does one thing even happen here? How do these relate to each other? What is the relationship from one to the next? What is the relationship between them? Do they share anything? Is there a base from which they operate? What does that mean? Performative. What performs? What performs what? Okay. They're all sort of, it's just random linguistic play?
I read the text, so I was looking at it's just many different ways or styles of describing the same thing or things.
Ah, it's that great phrase, right? Many different ways of describing the same thing. Is there a same thing? What I tried to push you towards in the reading Bart is this, is beginning to operate in a place in which there is no origin, in which really there is no base from which things operate. There's not first a truth and then a play with it. What I wonder in this text if this is in fact nothing but variation, Variation all the way. Turtles all the way down. Is there one thing and then variations on it? Or are there nothing but variations? Do you understand that question? That is really the question, man. What I got to get you to is to understand nothing but variation. In your belly of bellies, understand that there is no there first. The things are always already an argument. Things are always already a position. Things are always already inflected. They're already something. There is no neutrality. How do we approach this text? How can we even speak about this thing? Right? I mean, is it 99 different versions of the same thing? Are they just 99 different versions? Clearly there's some relationship between the parts. I mean, Augustine says, well, not really. But clearly there's some relationship between these parts. They don't just seem like random scribbles. It seems actually highly contrived, highly contained. It seems like a lot of limits that are placed on this text. Right? So it seems like anything but just a random throw of the dice. Right? There is a relationship between the parts. Is that fair to say? Does it seem like there's a relationship between these? Okay, there seem to be some common elements seem to weave through it, the bust, the button. At times, these things seem to give way, right, in sort of the more explicit plays, like in the permutations, right, where there seems to be no mention necessarily of buses or passengers or anything remotely referential at all. Sure. Yeah. So you can somehow, I like that. There's somehow a connection here. There does seem to be a connection. But the terms of that connection is one of the things we can interrogate and we will interrogate and this text does interrogate. It's one of them. I think this text makes arguments about the very nature of things. This is an ontology. Right? At the end of class on Tuesday, I said, talked about Merleau-Ponty. So Merleau-Ponty says that the house is what a house is the house seen from every perspective all at once. The house only exists in as much as it's seen, or it only comes into being in as much as it's seen. And that's a strong claim. It's not that first there's a house and then we see it. Right? And of course there are different ways of seeing. You turn your back, you still see it. Right, there's things called memory, and right? It's not that you make it appear by looking at it, but that something only comes to be in as much as it is experienced, as in as much as it's expressed, in as much as it has effect on the world. If it doesn't have effect on the world, then what is it? What argument does this text make? What arguments does this text make? Oh, I'll give it a shot. Well, I think it makes an argument about that once you dislocate the real, once you disobligate yourself from the real, once you're no longer tethered to the real, then there is a kind of infinite freedom. There's a kind of proliferation of possibilities. Right? So let's look at exercises in style. Right? If you look at the very first entry, it's notation. Is this the one from which the rest deviate? Or is this itself already a deviation? In what sense? If we say that this already is a deviation, I mean, doesn't this look like the bare facts? Doesn't this look like the description of what really happened? Most neutral? Most sort of objective? How? How does it make that argument? Stephanie's saying it's just another way of making the argument, and I'm with you. But it does seem it begins, the very first one. And it seems like, okay, this lays down the groundwork, and the rest all seem to play on it. Right?
Because if this is
Okay, so I want to do that. Screw perspective. I'm telling you the truth, man. This is the truth. The rest of you, you can have your little perspectives on it. So what? That doesn't tell me what really happened. Right? A lot of arguments against perspective as the grounds of truth. I mean, what I'm trying to give you as a casual argument really undoes the basis of all knowledge, politics, and, you know, life as you know it. Right? So most people would have you believe, whether they admit it or not, that there is a truth that exceeds our perspective. Right? Why isn't this the sort of proclamation, the real thing, from which everything else deviates? All right, say more. But say more about that. So John's saying the very first thing is, in fact, not the word in the S-bus. The very first thing we see is, in fact, a drawing of a body. So we've already left the realm of, according to John, we've left the realm of the kind of, that body forming a letter is already a deviation from a normal N, let's say. That's very nice. Does that make sense to everybody? That you say, well, where does the text begin? Well, maybe it begins with this body. And if it begins with this body, then this body is already an inflection, is already an argument, is already a deviation from that, which, of course, is itself already a deviation from what? I don't know. The typewriter? Helvetica? You got to always choose a font. Isn't that a great fact on your computer? You get to choose a font. Meaning that every letter is always an argument, right? Whether you, does anyone do like graphic design or typography? No? Yes? You'll get in arguments with designers, and designers will always make distinctions, you know, and argue the profundity of whether there's a serif or not on a letter. You know what a serif is? Serif are the little doohickeys that hang off a letters. So if I have an R, that would be an R sans serif, but if I put a little doohickey, right, that's a serif, right, this little thing here. So like when you use Times or New York, a fonts you use when you on your computer, almost everything you write, they're serifs. They're much easier to read. But what... The sort of contemporary mode of design is no serifs, like the gap. Right? It's, everything's clean. Right? Everything's super pristine. Sometimes very hard to read sans serif because it's just a block and it becomes a visual mark as opposed to giving you that letter right up front. So designers tend to like, contemporary designers like the sans serif. The argument I'm making is that you every time you go to write a letter, you've already inflected it. It's already an argument, whether you use a serif or not a serif, whether you use a big old goofy New York font or the Courier font or the Times font or the Times New Roman font. Those are different arguments. They inflect the body of the reader quite literally. They might not be that interesting an argument, but they quite literally change the face of the event. Right? It's why when I hand out your assignment next week, I'm going to specify your font. Because I don't want you guys making some old goofy fonts and we can't read them. And then it gets annoying. Right? So you will write in Times. And we'll choose 11 or 12 point. Probably 12 point. I need 12 point. Because 11 point, I'm getting old. You're writing 12 point. 11 point, and all of a sudden, you tell me it's not making an argument. You know, John and Vincent are going to be sitting there with these stacks of papers. Poor guys. They get paid more than I do. I'll shit you not. I get paid almost nothing, right? They'll be sitting there with a stack of papers, squinting away. By the time they get to the fifth, sixth paper, you got to hope that paper ain't yours. Right? Because every reading encounter is an encounter. It's an experience. You got to picture this experience. You write a paper, you got to picture these guys. Picture them reading it. That's why, you know, you hand in something off your inkjet printer and it's kind of smeared. You think, oh, okay. Right? What my basic argument's there, yes, but remember that all writing is a choreography of the body of the reader. How do you want to move the reader of the person determining your grade? How do you want to move them? Do you want them squinting, annoyed, can't read something? Or do you want it nice, clean, pristine? It's a slightly different experience. Yeah. Well, you know, once a serif, there's an argument for legibility for a serif. Of this particular R I wrote on the board,
sure.
You know, that I don't know, you tell me.
Well, I don't know. I don't know how to do it.
Yeah, it's not much there. It looks pretty much like scribble to me. You know, that I'm that this particular point is a heuristic. That little circle there, I kind of like, is sort of cool. I wish all writing had that little circle on it.
An impression,
but I think impression is such a good word. Think about how language makes an impression, right? Have you ever seen a printing press? Anyone ever use a printing press? My wife's a printmaker, right? Printing presses, huge roll machines, right? They weigh tons. You put down your metal plate and you put the paper right, and it pushes the ink into the paper. Can you picture what I'm talking about here? It makes an impression in the paper. So I like this notion of text make an impression. As you read, it impresses on you, and you get shaped that way a little bit. Just a little bit, right? The same way when you eat a banana, you got banana in you. It's in you, right? You got banana in you. It made an impression, right? When you eat uni, it's all about uni to me. I just wrote an article that uni is knowledge, which was really fun to write. You know uni? Sea urchin gonads? That's yummy. It's the king, man. It's the king. It's the best thing I know. That and Old Potrero single barrel rye whiskey. Very good. Very tasty. Very, very tasty. They make an impression on you. They literally move you. That seems obvious with food, right? But it's no different. I mean, it's different, but it still makes an impression. Words make an impression. Letters. The act of reading. To go back to our text, John's point here is that this will always already have been a deviation. He makes it quite explicit with the fact that it's a body. And we'll go back and we'll talk about why it's a body and the role of bodies and the relationship between bodies and language. That picture makes an argument about the relationship between human life, human bodies, and language. It makes an argument. It performs an argument. Okay, so the first question on the table was, well, is there an origin, an original, from which the rest of these exercises deviate? And the argument is no. It will always already have been a deviation. Right? There is no real. That's what John has argued. It begins with a deviation, this contorted body. Right? There is no real thing. There is no... Well, this thing happened on the bus, and then we can go play with it. When you say, this is what happened on the bus, you've already made an argument about what happened on the bus. Chernow's looking at me like I'm nuts. Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. It doesn't, and even if it did that, right? I mean, prefaces are great for that reason. You know, there's a whole rhetoric of the preface, right? If you look at prefaces of text that are really interesting, that will already undo the book in lots of different ways. I urge you to examine how prefaces don't frame a book, how they in fact unframe it, how they put it in play. Right? I love the idea of a book that summarizes itself at the beginning, which is so funny because it's, again, it's the author's already dead, because how do you... Let me summarize them. Why are you summarizing it for me? I don't know. A preface is, of course, already the beginning of an argument. The fact that there is a preface is an argument. The role of the preface is an argument. Right? So the fact that this text doesn't have a preface is interesting, but there's no stable meaning of what a preface is. Every preface is different. Every preface stands towards its text in a particular way.
This text actually has two prefaces.
Ah. That's hilarious. Right. One obnoxious one by the translator who tries to pretend he's Queneau. And they're both by him, right? Oh, her, Barbara Wright. Right. It's good. And then if you've been reading the preface, if you actually did read the preface, it's actually kind of interesting because these are translations. And so there, talk about like the deferment from the real. Right? A lot of these are written from scratch. Right? Because a lot of the jokes that happen in French are French jokes. They only work in the French language. And these jokes are only work in English. But it won't really matter because then these are just variations on variations. Translation is just a variation. But we know that language is always already a variation. There's nothing but variation. Variations on variations. Don't you ever listen to Johann Sebastian Bach? Isn't that what we just all casually listen to these days? When you go to church? Don't you all go to church and they play Bach, you know, fugues? It's just variations. Variations on variations on variations on variations. Right? What Queneau's doing here is very Baroque, is very much in the tradition of Baroque music. Baroque art, take one theme and vary it lots of different ways. Right? To the point where that original theme is now just another variation. Okay. Yeah.
So like going back to your example you used yesterday of like all the when you enter a house, enter all the different angles, get back close to the view of the house, don't all these variations kind of present what actually happened, I guess?
Okay, there's two interesting questions. The question on the table is, well, isn't this the sum of all these would actually happen?
Yeah.
Okay, that's a good question. There's a couple of different ways to answer it. One would be to say, how long is this book? Are there only 99 of these? How many variations are there? How many actually are there? Yeah, they're infinite. Is there any reason this would ever stop? Right? This book is infinite. This is clearly an abridgment of an infinite text. Does that make sense? You could always have another one. In fact, over the weekend, you're going to write one. That's going to be an assignment. I'm going to collect it. Right? You're going to write one of the variations on this text. I'm not kidding. That is your assignment. Right? And so we'll have now 100 more. Why would it ever stop? What would be the limit? And so your question you're asking is a very good one, right? So you say, well, isn't the thing that happened the sum of all the perspectives on it? Yes. And the perspectives are infinite. Right? Do you realize how freaking insane and beautifully, exquisitely, psychedelically insane that is? The thing is the sum of all the perspectives on it, and the perspectives on it are infinite. Which means that thing finally is infinite. Right? It means that a thing is never complete. Right? There's always another perspective. There's always another one. There's always another event. There's always another reading. There's somebody else to come look at that house. Does that make sense? The second response to what you said was, well, things start to get really weird at a couple points in this book. You're moving along, and it seems like their perspectives on something. But are they in fact perspectives on something? Are all of these perspectives? Look at page 129. And tell me if this is a perspective on something.
Could it be like a linguistic perspective?
Ah, I like that. Could it be a linguistic perspective? What would that mean? I like it, but what? Think how, push it a little bit. What is a linguistic perspective?
I guess, like, looking at this in terms of actual, like, letters and symbols rather than, like, a content.
Yeah. That's good. I mean, one thing that's really weird about a linguistic perspective, of course, is that to give language a perspective is really weird, right? It's to sort of shift the fundamental relationship between humanity and language. If language has a perspective too, right? There's my perspective, there's language's perspective. Could you picture calling language to the stand? What did you see that night? Verb? I mean, what? You couldn't even do the verb. You're trying to do all of language. What is the perspective of language? It's not that I'm disagreeing. I like it. But I want to push its madness, right? And I like this madness. The perspective of the linguistic. What Barthes tells us is the minute you write, you are anonymous. You are the body of language. That I is just the eye of language. This word I is this kind of portal, this open, lingering gap, this hole, I don't know what else to call it, this hole, this gap, this open spot, this invitation for you to come in and take on the perspective of language. Right? You become language at that point. When you say I, it's not you, it's the word I. It's your entry point into language. So the perspective of language, I like that. I like that, right? There's a point at which this text takes leave of the human, in a sense, right? That rather than there being... Right, so here's here's our bus. Right, and presumably something happens on the bus, right? And I guess one way to see this is to say, well, there's all these people around here. And everybody has their view on what happened. But Queneau's argument is stranger than this. He doesn't say, well, something happened, and then you all have your view. He's saying, this, first you have, in a sense, people's views, and then in their views, I don't even know how to draw this. The view of this thing is saturated with perspectives, right? So that there is no, you can't distinguish between the perspective, the outline of my perspective, and the outline of the event.
The very argument of a perspective is linear, so obviously they can't quite be the eye.
What do you mean?
In other words, if you speak of, when an individual speaks of a perspective, presumably they're speaking of something very linearly, or something that's very linear. Love.
Why is it linear?
Because it's the way an individual presumably sees.
Okay. Some one-to-one correlation or something. I mean, what this suggests, to still have the bodies looking at the thing, right? All right, let me back up. I'll try to walk you through this little movement I want to make. I wish I was like that guy on UPS who could actually draw. Who is that guy? I know he's must be some guy. Must be somebody. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, Bob Moss.
Is that who does the drawing? I don't know. I'm talking about these UPS ads. UPS ads. UPS ads. The guy's got to forget it. I watch American Idol. I see ads. That's how I know ads. So, one view that we got rid of, right, is that there's a bus. A potential argument could be that first there's the bus, and then people come and look at it. Something happens on the bus, and then we have our take on it. But what we argued is this text argues against this. Why? Because there's always already a deviation. There's already that N that's been bent by humanity. That N of notation, right from the get-go. You with me at all? So there's not first an event and then our perspectives on it. All there are our perspectives on it. That means the very constitution of this thing, the very making of this thing, the very conjuring of this thing into existence, its very ontogenesis, to give you another sexy sort of word to alienate you from everyone you like, right? Ontogenesis, right? Genesis being creation, onto being being. The generation of being. The very ontogenesis of this thing, the very coming into being of it, the very creation, its very existence is all of the perspectives on it. That means my looking at it makes it. The looking here makes it. This looking makes it. This looking makes it. You with me? Yeah. No. No. Because of course it makes a sound. Just because I don't hear it doesn't mean it doesn't make a sound, right? Just because I don't look at the bus doesn't mean the bus doesn't exist, because the bus is still seen by other things. But that gets more complicated, right? Because eventually, what I'm about to show you is, you know, this lectern is looking at the table, it's looking at me. We're going to get over the human thing. That's the problem there, right? Tree falls in the forest. Well, the tree knows it fell. The tree heard it. You think trees don't hear things? Right? What we're going to do now is get rid of the privilege of the human. Because what this still suggests is that my human vision conjured it into existence. Does that make sense? It gives a lot of power to my ability to see things. Sort of like the tree only makes a sound if I hear it. But that's not the case either. I'm not that powerful. Right? I am taken up by language. Right? Because if this is true, right? If my perspective brings this into being, well then, and that is the grounds of all ontogenesis, well then, I am nothing but my perspective, and I am nothing but perspectives on me. Right? Why is this person somehow outside of the rules of what happens to this bus? If this incident on the bus can only come into being through all the perspectives, through people actually having experiences on the bus. Again, picture this incident on the bus. It's a whole network. There's a guy with a long neck, there's a button, there's someone looking at it. From whose perspective is there an absolute view? Who constitutes this real thing? It doesn't exist. It's an event that's networked between all possible people who have any view onto it, including the participants. Yeah. This is Illinois. Exactamundo, right? That's where this is going. Right? What were you going to say, Priscilla?
I have two questions.
Yeah.
One is, okay, so for the permutations, these are basically words chopped up and rearranged.
Yes.
So isn't that implying that the words chosen to rearrange are origins?
Absolutely, right. It's one of
them.
Yeah. It's very good, right? So the question on the table is if these permutations, what are they permutations of?
Yeah.
Right? Are they permuting something that pre-exists the permutation?
And does that have something to do with if the permutations are the only titles that don't have the body?
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, let's come back to that. That's a very good question. That is the right question.
What about God?
What about God?
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Does a lot of this theory presuppose like that you don't believe if that someone doesn't believe in the idea of God?
No, what this theory says is that a belief in God is an argument in another perspective. You immediately get folded back in. To stop it all and say, no, there is a perspective that's true, well then, okay, that's fine, but you're not in this class anymore. You've made an argument. Yeah, there is something radically a-religious about what I'm telling you. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, we're neither believe or don't believe in God. What we're interested in is when someone says they believe in God, what happens? What God do you believe in? How does that work? How does that function? What are the effects of that? Nietzsche made an entire philosophy on this. He wrote a book called On the Genealogy of Morals, in which he tracks the effects of morality. The effects of people who believe in morality. And he discovers that there are a bunch of sniveling sadomasochists. But that's ill-constituted for this world. But that's Nietzsche's argument. I'm not saying that.
So every perspective is really just a point.
Huh?
So every perspective is really just a point of origin.
No. Who's ever said that? What I'm actually trying to say is the opposite. That there is, in fact, just a network without origin. And that I now am networked within this event. So the next stage is not just that my gaze constitutes the thing, but that the reverse is also true, and that my gaze is created by this thing. The incident doesn't exist distinct from my perspective. My perspective is not distinct from the thing. They're one and the same thing. Right? So that what Queneau argues when he starts getting to these pure linguistic games, to these odes, to these plays, to these sonnets, is that it's not just a human being that's being taken up, but perspective itself, which is expression, which is language. that what Quinault gives us is a world writ all the way through with the linguistic. That in a sense, this incident on the bus is thoroughly metabolized by language, but was in fact always already metabolized by language. I like that you have no idea what I'm talking about. It makes me feel good. I'm serious. You'll know how lonely it is. I'm not kidding. All right. My little mic's getting all screwed up here. All right, so let's get rid of this illustration, because I think maybe this is just not working. All right, so one argument this text makes is that there is no real, per se, but that's not a problem. All there are these perspectives, and these perspectives are infinite. Does that seem fair to make? Can we say that? Do you feel good about that? This text, this little playful little text, makes the argument that there's no real, there's nothing but perspectives always and already. This is one of the most profound books of philosophy you will ever read. So, I believe that the only reason we can say that is because we've read Austin, and we've read Bart, and we know that texts perform their arguments. They don't have to just tell us their arguments. They perform their arguments. So this text creates, enacts, brings into being an argument through its performance. Right? It is one reason why in rhetoric, you know, people sometimes call rhetoric, somewhere between literature and philosophy. It's because we can read literary texts as philosophic texts, as claims about the world, and at the same time we can read philosophical texts as literary. Right? We can talk about their strategies, their rhetorical strategies, not just about their arguments. That's why sometimes people are inclined to say that, if you've ever heard that. Rhetoric's a mix of literature and philosophy. It's again because we take the literary, what's called fiction, and look at it as not necessarily as fiction, but as creations of the world, as claims to knowledge, as claims to truth, and we look at books that claim to know the truth as literary texts. Is that fair? Isn't that right? Sure, all right, they're just nodding along. Keep going, Coffeen. Okay, so we know that there's no such thing as neutral argument, as neutral language. Right? That's the argument this text makes, that even at notation, you're already getting an argument. The minute you utter, the minute you exist, the minute you express, which is to be alive, you can't express without being alive. Should look at your faces, right? You don't say a word, but you're expressing all kinds of things. And that's what life is. You read the world. The world is your faces, is your body. You're always already expressing. Not just when you speak, you're already using language. And you look up at me like with disdain, with confoundment, boredom, all those things, you're expressing. That's language. You're communicating to me. Right? You can't help but do that. You can't help but always be expressing something. There's no neutral. How would you be neutral? Right? I mean, think about computer voices, right? And the way, you know, your Mac talks to you. Or the way, what's the first thing you think of when you hear that computer voice speak? Why is Stephen Hawking speaking to me? Right? That's your first thought is, huh? I guess they put him inside every machine. Okay. No, that's not possible. He's not that smart. Right? That you are your expression, right? That's what I'm saying is you could be thinking anything you want. You could have any intention you want. All there is your expression. Right? There's no you lurking behind your own expression. You are a surface. Right? Your dead is all author of your own actions, as the authority of your own actions. You're just an expression, and then that gets interpreted by the world. Right? There's no you. There's just what you do. There's your actions. There's no such thing as you. There's only your actions. That's the argument being made by this text. That's a pretty big argument. Very large. Large, about this big. I tried to explain infinity to my little boy last night. And he kept swearing that 82.46.1 was bigger. I was like, yes, but you add one to it. 24.22.221 cents. Not a genius, my child. I kind of gave up. It's hard. How do you explain the infinite? I kept going. I realized I was an idiot. I kept saying, it's infinite. It's all of them. It's more. Terrible teacher. All right. So there is no neutrality, right? Does that make sense to you? I need you to feel that in your belly of bellies. That there's no, picture those newscasters. Picture those creepy ass soulless mofos, right? Like on the news trying to tell you, you know, that 10,000 people were just slaughtered in, you know, some third world place because I don't know why they feel like I got to know that, right? But they, what voice is it they tell you that in? Is that neutral? Or is that just creepy soulless? Right, what would the neutral voice be? The dictionary? We'll do poetical dictionaries. Is a dictionary neutral? No, it's just kind of monotone. It's monotone neutral? How do you not inflect your expression? There's no such thing. You're always inflected. You're always shaped. You're always making an argument. Every utterance, every burp, every gesture, everything is an argument. There's no way for it not to be. How do you withhold your argument? Your argument might not always be that interesting. Might not always be that complex. But it's always an argument. It's always a posture. It's always, there is no neutral place in the world. That's what I told you from day one. Everything is an argument. Everything. God, morality, authorship, truth, your face, your you know, your little weird private conversations in your head, all arguments. All of them are arguments. They're inflections. They're not true or not true. We don't care. The very question of truth is rendered by the wayside. We don't care. It's moot. What we're interested in are effects. How does it go? What argument do these little drawings make? Come on, these drawings are fan-freaking-tastic. Right? I mean, hilarious, beautiful. What argument do they make? How do they make that argument? Okay. But what? How, just because it's a body, how do I know that it's a beginning? How does one equal the other here? How do I get from the fact that it's a body to the infinite? Because it seems like a body's really limited. What makes me infinite? I like that. You're like, you're speaking to Luz and Guatri to me, and you don't even know it. Yeah, it's always in the middle. It's always happening. That's a really good way to put it. Right? What's your name?
Chris.
You're what Chris said. He says, it's always in the middle. There's no setup for it. It happens. It's already happening. Right? And there's no, it can't end because it's always in the middle. That's a really smart argument. Right? Really kind of interesting. The text is always in the middle. It doesn't have a clear closure. What I'm not quite sure is how the illustrations make that argument. I guess you're saying, well, it's the body, but they do have faces and feet. Yeah, I guess.
Every body is making a different posture, different argument, a different gesture.
Okay, good. Good, good, good.
Synonymous of all things.
Right. So the body's body inflects somewhat differently. Yeah.
The language is a contortion.
Language is a contortion. Look at these bodies. Look how shaped they are. By the language, right? They don't make any shape they want to make. They're, in fact, subscribing to a local law. The law of N, the law of O, the law of P, right? It's sort of like, or the law of downward dog, right? I mean, it's the law of a local prescription of your action. Bend like this. But what is the status of this contortion?
Yeah. Takes it farther away from, not say this isn't like a serious document, but it is
Very status of the serious, I think, is, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, joke and humor, those are weird words. They're really loaded, and they need interrogation in and of themselves and what their status are. I mean, one argument that will be weaved through this class, will get very explicitly in McLuhan, and then again in Plato, is that the only way to be to live this life seriously is never to be serious. Right? The status of the serious is itself up for grabs here. I agree with you. This text kind of introduces play as a mode of engaging the world. Right? That the play is not necessarily not serious. Right? Imagine that every time you wanted to actually make a claim about the world, you always had to be serious. And we do kind of have that belief that somehow the serious is when things get real. Stop joking around. Be serious with me for a minute. And then things are real. No, they're just serious. I mean, you think about the argument of friendship. Are friends the people that you're serious with or the people you play with? Imagine a friend who was always serious. You'd be like, that person's annoying. That person's not more real, the person's annoying, right? And the person who's kind of playful, you're like, I want to hang out with that dude. That's good, that's fun.
I was just going to underscore the whole idea of the local law.
Yeah, yeah.
Just because you get letters that are repeated through the bodies, like on 88 through 92, you have Cockney cross-examination and comedy, three C's in a row, but they're all different.
Beautiful, 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 right. That's what we're getting towards. Okay, so what Vincent's pointed out is sort of the next question I have for you. So if we can say these languages are contortions, but contortions sound kind of sound pretty aggressive. They sound like something you don't want to avoid. But is that the mood here? What are the terms of these contortions? Look at the are these people in pain? Are they being broken? Yeah, I like that, right? To maintain the health, we have to keep doing these exercises, keep pushing language to its limits in order to maintain health. It's a very Nietzschean argument, right? What Nietzsche will do throughout his philosophy is replace the quest for truth with the quest for health. Right? I'll say the main question of philosophy is, what do you eat, where do you live, and how do you recreate? What are you eating? He's not kidding. It's not a metaphor. What are you eating? And he starts telling you what he eats. He doesn't like coffee, it gives him the shits. He doesn't really like booze, it gives him a headache. He likes a little bit of tea, maybe some cocoa. You know? He's not kidding. Shifts the question away from truth to health. That's the goal. And he says, if I look at the whole history of philosophy and the history of civilization through this rubric of health, then it looks like all these philosophers and all these Christians are really sick. They're really sickly, grotesque people. They're ill-constituted. Right? Something's wrong with them. That's his whole view, right? You shift your perspective away from truth to health, the world looks very different. If health is your goal, if health is your metaphysic, if health is your end objective, and you read everything by its healthfulness, right? Then the way you read the world will change dramatically. So yeah, I like that. These exercises are for health. So look at these bodies. It's good. Do they look like they're in pain, or do they look actually like they're getting stretched out?
The naked, too. I was thinking actually, like, on
future. Kind of naked.
Sexual resistance, right? Well, or yeah. Even in yoga, like,
yeah.
Why do you do these? You exercise or you push your body to the limits, right? So it's almost telling me, like, you're pushing language to its limits.
Yeah. But by pushing language to its limits, I also push the body to its limits. What's beautiful here is that the relationship between language and people is intimately intertwined. Think about if these illustrations were there were the end, and then there were a body climbing on it. What argument would that make? The first there was the structure, the edifice of the letter, and then there were bodies climbing on the letter. Exactly, right? That language is there, and I can go and play on it. It might be fun to play on,
but that this play of language and my body are different things. But that's not what Queneau does. He makes the language and the body one and the same freaking thing. So the body pushes language, and language pushes the body into these strange positions, like yoga, like the Kama Sutra. Right? It's like, I never thought about doing it that way. But all of a sudden, you know, if you do it, you might actually discover all kinds of new delights, pleasures, and health. Right? So these exercises in language actually extend the human, and at the in the exact same breath, extend language. The linguistic and the human are so thoroughly intertwined with each other, right, that it's not that one dictates the terms to the other, it's that they dictate the terms to each other mutually. So as Vincent points out, there's three C's in a row, and the body has, there is a law there. To make that C, you have to make a C. If you make another shape, you make a different letter. But there's at least three different ways to do it. So it's a law, but it becomes this kind of very beautiful, flexible law. Right? Absolutely determinative and absolutely free at the same time. Yeah. Very good. So the question is, why do they look kind of unnatural, is your word, right? They don't look natural. Why not? Maybe because what we call natural, I mean, look at you guys. I got terrible posture. Look at you, all slumped in these chairs. This is natural. Right? Why does the Kama Sutra give us these elaborate positions? You know, I know like 2 or 3, 4, 5 ways of doing it. How come they got hundreds in the Kama Sutra? Why? Why in a yoga do they do these ridiculous things? You got to stand on your head or twist up like a pretzel. What? Why? Yes, you have to take yourself out of the regular. Precisely because it's what you call natural is in fact an argument. Right? Whatever is considered natural is often the most insidious argument. It's natural. Think about it. I can tell you what's natural, and then I can think of obscene things. I can make certain arguments about certain things are just natural. This is just natural. And what's your counter argument, right? Well, it's either not natural, or I ain't doing it anyway, prof. Like, the natural is a really insidious argument. And so whatever gets called natural needs to be interrogated. Always. What are you calling natural? What are the effects of saying that that's natural? Right? Is it only natural for men and women to get married? That's natural? Where does that come from? That's a weird argument. What's at stake in that? Who says that, you know, it's only natural for, real, heterosexual penetration? That's natural. Homosexual penetration isn't natural. Huh? From where? What's at stake in that? Who's most nervous about that? Probably people who don't really, afraid of things up their butt. Right? Who probably desire it. I mean, it's complicated. Right? The natural, the point being that there is no such thing as the natural. The natural is always an argument. Who's saying what is natural? Right? I mean, coming from my world, that's very secluded from a lot of the public. Right? You know, where newspapers don't watch much besides HBO and don't see a lot of films, popular movies. When there was an argument against same-sex marriage, I'm so confused. I really have no idea what the argument against that could possibly be. I find it utterly confounding. It's very, very strange to me. Right? Because you want to get married. That marriage strikes me as the most unnatural thing I can imagine to begin with. Right? I can't imagine why anyone would want to do this. Don't ask me why I did. Right? And then, I just don't... Clearly what someone else is thinking of natural to me is insane. So, when Queneau gives us these bodies that are distended, stretched, shaped in these really elaborate, contorted ways, it's precisely to redefine the natural, for language to push and redefine the natural constantly on the fly. To recreate the norm.
Yeah, thanks. What do you, how do contortions are perceived by yourself as being painful or the elongation, would that throw into confusion how you would perceive the infinite possibilities of the use of language and your perceptions on that? Like, what if you perceive it as painful rather than, oh, this is just a new beautiful way of seeing the shape of the human body in relation to the...
Absolutely. So the question on the table is, well, if it's painful, do I still got to do it? Shouldn't I just stay with what's comfortable and nice? Is that what you're asking me?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah, I'm just giving you a different model of learning and saying, you know, like we're clearly privileging the new, the difference, and the unfamiliar over the familiar. Many people argue for the familiar. Quinault's arguing for the unfamiliar. Right, for the extension. And sometimes it hurts. Sorry, Lex. where were we? Somewhere no doubt good. Was that all the illustrations? Yeah, these great illustrations.
Also, like, maybe language also, because it looks like they're, you know, they're backs, or they're going to get broken there. It looks like language can break backs.
Absolutely. You know, there's a certain belief that we're constrained by language, that language can be thought of as a constraint, perhaps, as a prison house. There's a book by Frederick Jameson called The Prison House of Language, which is an out-of-context quote from Nietzsche. The prison house of language. I can't think it unless I have the word for it. We're constrained by language. But what Quinault's arguing here is this limit is infinite. It's not that we're necessarily constrained, although we are constrained. But we have to rethink what freedom is in the first place. Is freedom freedom from constraint? I don't think so. I think it's a banal understanding of freedom. Freedom is the ability to act within constraints. Right? So, to wit, one way, I mean, let's think about, we just read The Death of the Author. How does this text perform this death of the author? In what ways can we not say that Raymond Queneau is the author? What way can we say that Raymond Queneau is not the author? And there's clearly a kind of wizardry here, a kind of mastery, right? And that Queneau can just come along and be like, yeah, throw it on, give it to me, baby. I'll spin this thing 10,000 ways. There's clearly a kind of mastery here. He's got something going on, right? That he can write. Some of these are hilarious. Super prodigious. Not that easy to do. You know, style after style after style. But in what ways is he abdicating his authority? How does this text perform his own abdication of the throne, his own suicide as authority over his own text? Oh, I'll tell you. You know, all of these entries, right? If you look at the table of contents, these really read as a list of laws, a list of constraints. That in a way what this text has done is you know, the writer comes along and says, give me limits. Give me limits. I want the limit. First, give me the limit of one presumed incident, one thing. Make it incredibly boring. And then I'm going to create a whole proliferation of laws to inflect it. What's beautiful is notation is notation. Olfactory is olfactory. Metaphor is metaphoric. Exclamation is exclamation. He keeps following his own law. He keeps performing the law that he's been asked to follow. He could have jammed it, right? Notation could in fact be olfactory. Olfactory could in fact be sensory or tactile. He could have kept jamming the laws, but he doesn't. He loves the law. Give me laws, he says. Give me more and more laws. Give me an infinite number of laws. I'll follow them all. What a weird declaration of freedom. Give me your laws. I'll follow them all. There's an infinite number of laws. He is the most generous lawgiver. Think about Moses comes down, and he's got his freaking laws in stone. In stone. It says here what not to do. Lots of things not to do. Think about Quinault as Moses. Comes down with his laws, and they're infinite. There's as many different laws as there are perspectives. The minute he has subjective and then another subjectivity, There also could be another subjectivity, another subjectivity, another subjectivity, right? Just at that point. You with me on that subjectivity thing? Right? The subjective side, another subjectivity. Well, of course, there could be another subjectivity, another subjectivity, another subjectivity. That's already an infinite series. The permutations is an infinite series. He starts coming up with these tropes, you know, and they're, can I tell you, in rhetoric, there are, like, these, you know, I used to include it in the reader. I don't think it's in there now, the list of figures and tropes. Like, tens of thousands of different ways of permuting, changing, substituting letters for other letters, repeating certain phrases. Think about all the genres, all the different ways he could inflect the story. There's an infinite number. Does that make sense to you? When I say there's an infinite number of ways this tale can be told, are you with me on that point? Yes? If that's true, then there's an infinite number of laws that he will gladly submit himself to. So his freedom is to submit to an infinite number of laws. He seems to have a kind of relish for the law. Yeah, give me another constraint. It's kind of like the improv comedy group says, come on, yell something out. Come on, give it to me. I'll do something with it. They want the limit. And in that limit, they find a kind of infinite freedom. Think how weird that is. Limit and freedom now are no longer opposed terms. Just as for Nicholson Baker, as for Nietzsche, fate and chance are not opposed terms. Okay. So here's Quinault. He's not really the authority at all. On the contrary, he becomes a kind of cog within a little machine, a little computational machine that keeps spitting out different variations. Right? But he's not even the originator of it. It comes to him. Right? So the law gets dictated first. Dream, prognostication, comedy, asides, parakresis, spectral, philosophic. He's like, okay, I'll do that one. Okay, yeah, give me that one. But he's always submitting. His authority is handed over to language. Quite explicitly, the authority of this text is in fact in the table of contents, is in fact not just quite in the table of contents, because what the table of contents gives us is a proliferation of laws. So you get all these little local laws, the law of the dream, the law of the anagram, the law of the sonnet, the law of the olfactory, the law of the gustatory. So it's not really the table of contents is already the site of great multiplicity, of proliferation of laws, of infinite laws. And so do you have any idea what I'm talking about? Right? That he is really, you know, again, over the weekend, you will write one of these. Right? You will write number 100. All of you. Right? You'll have to figure out another way, a permutation, another way to spin this. What will be your take? And what's complicated, and you find yourself in the position of not being the authority, not just because I made the assignment, but because you have to find a law that you will then submit to. Does that make sense? Do you see how each one of these exercises performs the law? Doesn't just describe the law, performs it. He enacts it. He actually lives under it. The language bends thoroughly to the rule of the law. The sonnet really is a sonnet. It doesn't just kind of sonnet-esque. It doesn't kind of like just speak about sonnets. It's a sonnet. Ode is an ode. Right? The comedy is a little play he wrote that is written. Right? But he is not the authority here. He is the sort of joyful abdicator of the throne. He is the proliferator of more laws that he'll have to submit to. But they're not really quite his laws per se. They're the laws of language, the laws of what can happen with language. All the different possibilities of style. He doesn't make up the style of a certain genre. He just follows it. Does that make sense? How this text performs the death of the author. You see how Quinault is a kind of master of us in a certain sense, but he's a master again in the way that the improv comedian is. Right? The improv comedian who's responding to people yelling things out of the crowd has to respond to what you gave him or her. So it's a kind of mastery, but it's mastery the way a surfer is a master. And the surfer is not the authority over that wave. Right? A surfer who thinks he's the authority over that wave, my guess, has another thing coming. Right? Is that right? Surfers? You got to bend to the will of that wave, but not bend totally to the will of that wave. You got to work with that wave. That wave is a potentially generous law, but equally, you know, willing to kill you. There was a hand somewhere. Yeah, kind of, except that, you know, these are not, in a sense, these are tropes. He didn't make up the tropes, right? He has to go find the law to follow, right? And so, again, it's a question, again, of authority, not a question of active participation. He actively chooses these things, but is he the authority over what he writes? Right? The person who authoritatively finds a law that he's got to submit to is in a complicated position, not really quite the authority. Might be a kind of master, might have a fair amount of control, but it's different than being the authority over it. Right? I mean, because once he gives himself the law, he's got to follow it. Or he's failed. It doesn't work. Right? So you anoint a king to rule over you. Are you really still the one in control? What's nice here is that the thing that's in control are all these different laws of language. This, right? So we get a few things worth noting here. One is this that for Queneau, for this text, for Exercises in Style, limits and freedom are not opposed terms. Right? That that he has this kind of will to proliferate laws. Not just pure freedom, but to proliferate laws, and in these laws find a freedom. Right? If we say this book is infinite, what we mean is there's an infinite number of laws, an infinite number of constraints. It's a very different relationship to the law than, say, Moses and the Old Testament. It comes down with laws written in stone, with etched in stone dictates. Thou shalt not boff thy neighbor's wife. Or it's covet. I guess you can boff her, you can't covet her. It's complicated. Right? Can you have sex with her, but you just can't covet her? I bet not. I don't know. I'm not a hermeneut of such things.
I found the 100th story already.
There you go. So you read the 101st.
Right,
I'm not kidding about this assignment. I'm collecting them. I'll even write on the board for you for Tuesday. Right, 100th exercise. I will collect these. I will read them. You might, your GSS might also ask that you bring them to class. I don't know, but you're bringing them to mine, and I'm collecting them. One to section, okay. Two copies. One to section, one to here. Not a good day to cut. Anyone emails them to me, I ain't printing them. But I'll put that all on the blog. All right. I was going to play. Do we have a little bit of time here? Okay, so one way to think about this question of the relationship between these stories and the lack of the real, one way to think about it is through the common practice of the cover song. Right? One artist covers a song by another artist. Okay, what are the ways of covering that artist? Is there a way of covering it in which the original is in fact no longer the original? Right? Think about a band that's, you know, like a Lynyrd Skynyrd cover band, right? And they're really faithful to Skynyrd. Well, they're really into copying Skynyrd then in a way. But you can picture a Lynyrd Skynyrd cover that doesn't sound anything like Lynyrd Skynyrd, that really tries to digest the song really differently. So I have four versions of one song. Should we listen to some of these? We have like 10 minutes? Okay. We won't be able to listen to the whole song. Hopefully this will work. No. Which is authentic? You could go look it up online and bring in things about the author, but hearing the songs, which is the original?
does it matter? All there are variations. You could say, well, no, one came first. Well, how would you know that? I played you three in a row. On my iPod, I could scramble them any which way. How do you know one comes first? Well, historically, no. You could go keep finding facts that are not present to try to make an argument about what counts as authentic. But I'm saying in the act of listening, what counts as original or authentic? Each one becomes another permutation, another variation, another exercise. It's a possibility. A song is nothing but a possibility. Think about when the Stones are writing Satisfaction. Which version is the real one? The one that actually goes on vinyl? How about all the versions they threw in the garbage? Right? Think about when they're in the studio. First, think about when, you know, Mick first writes and he's got his little acoustic guitar. Right? There's recently was a release of a very early, I have it on here, of Black Francis, Frank Black from the Pixies, with his original demo for Surfer Rosa and Come On Pilgrim. And it's just him in his house with an acoustic guitar. Although, is that the real one? Or is it the one that gets released actually on the record? I'll play, to me, what is the only real version of Satisfaction. Right? In the back of your head, you can picture all of your, you know, your like hippie parents. You know, or maybe you guys are already post-boomer. I don't know. Your boomer parents? I guess not. They're already younger than that, right? Go, no, the Stones, man. And there's a whole ethos of that. And a whole pathos of that, of the original, yeah, no, man, it's all downhill since the Stones. What I'm saying now, have a different perspective. That's an argument about the authentic and the real. But what happens when we displace that and just say it's nothing but variations? I have an album after teaching this class, actually at the Art Institute, a student bought me an album of nothing but covers of the same song by Bjork. And there's like a punk rock, I mean, there's like four punk rock versions. There's one just on an accordion. There's one country version. And it's a kind of delirium. It turns out she was flooded with these songs. People just started sending her versions of the song. And by the time you're done listening to the record, you don't even know what the song is anymore. There is no real song. Right? Every song that even appears on a record is already a series of variations. How does it get to that point? Perfect, right? What difference does it make? To me, it's like, which version do I like? Sometimes I love the Cat Power. Always come back to that Devo. That Devo version is one of like the greatest things ever written. Right? The Britney's a little boring, I gotta tell you. The Stones is really boring. I'll take Britney over the Stones any day in that version of the song, right? It's just, what do you like? Think about how you make your assessment. Once you exile the very question of which is the real or the authentic, once those aren't even on the table anymore, how do you address the world? All these different versions, there's nothing but versions. And then each one, you make up your mind based on tons of different things. Maybe you don't have to make up your mind. You just enjoy or don't enjoy at that particular moment or not. Right? Who cares which is the real one? Screw this whole classic rock nonsense. Right? It's all in play. Right? That's what's beautiful about the database, what's beautiful about iTunes, what's beautiful about the iPod, is it's all splayed. It's not historical, the iPod. Everything exists in the same time on your iPod. Right? You can have Bach on there. You could have Britney on there. It doesn't matter. They all exist in the same time. Right? You can make your own historical trajectories. All right. Was that helpful? One thing quickly to think about then, when you think about the cover song, are all the various ways one can stand towards another, right? And so again, there can be like homage. Right? You can say, okay, I really respect you, or you can say, okay, I'm going to copy your style and I'm going to copy it, or I'm going to take your mood and inflect it differently. I mean, I got that great, you must all know that great Cardigans cover of Iron Man by Black Sabbath. No? Isn't Cardigan something you guys did? I have no idea what I'm talking about. Well, Cardigans is recent. Maybe that's like 15 years old. All right. Think about how these relate to each other, and I want you to think about the series. No, there's no real, but they still have a relationship to each other. Think about how this text is not random, right? But in fact, inflects itself relemlessly. All right, you have another assignment too for Tuesday. Read on Truth and Lies.
right? The essay by Nietzsche. Okay, so you're reading Nietzsche and you're writing up one of these things. You actually have something to do for this class. Oh my God! All right, have a good weekend.